Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 61, titled Three Kinds of Giving.
There are. Not only that, but it's not a matter of worthy. Sometimes people will be harmed by over-generosity. You know, in other words, it will not be good for them. They won't know what to do it. It's like the people who win the lottery. Often they lose all their friends. They end up in bankruptcy. They go crazy, you know. And it ruins their lives. They had a nice balanced life before that. And then Ed McMahon shows up with a $1 million check and everything is goes to hell. And everybody hates them. Everybody wants to have them. Give us some, you know, this kind of thing. So, it's not that. It's a question of, it may be so, and giving requires judgment and wisdom, of course. But it's best for the person. It's like forgiveness, for example. You can say some people are not worthy of forgiveness. No, they aren't. But actually, the forgiver is the one who benefits out of the forgiveness. Because they don't nurture resentment, which makes you sick. You know, and hatred and anger and wish for revenge, which doesn't help. The revenge doesn't help. And, you know, the people, the death penalty people, you know, have shown that with films and studies and interviews. You know, the people who, you know, I can't have closure until that guy's killed, you know, who killed my whatever. But then once they are killed, they don't feel any better at all. And then some people, they go and they talk to the murderer and get to see it as a human being. And they try to, of course, they don't forgive having what happened. They don't. But they, by forgiving, they are much happier, right? So the point of giving, again, actually there's a Tibetan joke about that. There's a nomad who has a fantastic bunch of dri butter. The female yak is called a dri. Never mention yak butter to a Tibetan, that they laugh. Because the yak is only the male. Huh? Female is called a dri, D-R-I, dri. And dream butter, but it's very high butter fat content, delicious butter. And then it was wrapped in a kind of intestine sort of thing, you know, like a sausage. And he brought this really good butter, this nomad, to give to a lama. And then he went to a teaching. And this lama was giving a teaching that involved a lot of visualization. It was quite complicated, you know. And then Buddha's up here, and there's three or four Buddhas on this side, that side. And then you imagine that this happens and that happens. And then you make an offering of another thing. And then the Buddha sends light rays down to you, and then they have this kind of practices. So the nomad was a very simple sort of person, and he was getting frustrated by inability to do the visualization. So at the end, after the thing is over, there's like a receiving line where they get the lama's blessings, and people make a gift to the lama. It's usually Tibetan culture, it's like that. So he comes, and he's got his butter, which he brought to give to the lama. And he comes up to the lama and he says, you know, I brought this butter to make a donation to you. But now, since I learned about the power of visualization, I want you to visualize that I'm giving it to you, and I'm going to keep it. And he went back to his tent. The lama didn't get the butter. So, you know, giving any kind of act is complicated, and we work at it, you know. But it's really best for the giver. The giver is the one who truly benefits, you know. So and again, the generosity part is the ability to give, and particularly like something that you really like, you know, to give it something, you know, even if it's not a valuable thing, but it's something you're attached to, you know. And you know, there are stories about lamas who are great yogis, and who had achieved what they call rainbow body, where they could leave with their body and have the body dissolve into light at death, you know, this type of thing. And then yet their friend or their guru or something, or even their disciple, comes and they're sort of still stuck in their hospital bed or in their tent or whatever it is, in their retreat place, and they're not there. And then they haven't disappeared yet, although it's time to go. And then they find out that someone a week before had come and given them a new shirt that they really like, kind of shirt. And then they make them take off the shirt, and then they disappear. Oh. The story's like that. So it's a question of your own sense of attachment that's really key. And, you know, people in foundations, know how difficult it is to give well and intelligently, you know. And that's, it's important to do that. Okay, so there's said to be three kinds of giving. There's the giving of material objects. There's the giving of security and protection. Those are two. But the most important is the giving of teaching, they say. Because teaching, and this could be on the worldly level, about a skill, you know, and it's that same old idea that, you know, give them a fishing rod and or a net or how to catch a fish rather than just send a bunch of fish. You know, give them a way of growing something where they can then have long-term, you know, viability rather than just sending a bag of wheat or something like that, you know. So, although when they're in a destitute situation, of course, the bag of wheat is a really great gift. The material thing is really great. But the idea of teaching is that the more realistic a person becomes, the more better off they'll be, the happier they'll be, the more satisfied they'll be, no matter what level of a possession they have. So that's why that's considered the highest kind of giving, giving teaching. And giving protection is good, you know, against protecting someone against bullies or dangers or whatever. And giving material things is, of course, also very good. Although then the transcendent giving is different from regular giving in the sense that it must be, they say that wisdom, that's why I also like to do wisdom first. Wisdom is like the eyes of the other virtues. So when you give, wisdom makes you not perceive, not fixate upon the giver, the gift, and the recipient. Or sometimes they do it to the three sectors, or sometimes that, or sometimes the giver, the gift, and the act of giving, they sometimes say. And they don't bring the recipient. There are two versions of that. I don't really know the difference, frankly, now that I think of it. But anyway, the non-perception of them is the way to give. In other words, it becomes like a spontaneous thing, so that you don't reward yourself by thinking, or expect a thank you, or say, oh, I'm so great, I'm so generous, I gave that gift, or aren't they nice, I gave them something, why aren't they appreciating it, this kind of thing. There's a, it's called the non-perception of the three sectors or segments of the act. And any kind of transcendent giving is like where it just happens, you know, and one doesn't congratulate oneself about it. So that's considered very important to be spoiled the gift. For example, there was a famous great master, Aryadeva, his name, who was a disciple of another famous one called Nagarjuna, and he had to go somewhere to save a monastery from somebody. Long story, I won't tell. But on the way, his teacher predicted that you're going to have a challenge, and whatever you do out of that, when you're challenged by something, don't regret it, and it will work out. And so they say that when he was traveling on the road to his destination, a blind beggar came up to him and asked him for one of his eyes for a transplant. And so he plucked out his eye and gave it to him because he was a very highly developed being. He just plucked it out and gave it. Not too surgically clean and a little messy, but he did that. And then he remembered Nagarjuna's thing. He said, oh, I shouldn't regret this. And it won't matter, you know. So then he walked on. But then he couldn't restrain his curiosity. He wanted to see if the beggar was seeing, had managed to implant it. And when he looked back, the beggar had failed to implant it. Apparently the beggar, you know, I detailed the story. The Indians have the detail, like maybe the beggar said he was a doctor or he would take it to a doctor or whatever. And however, he failed to do it, he was smashing it on a stump with a stone. So then he regretted only that it didn't work. He didn't regret giving it, but then therefore he never got his eye back, according to the Buddhist idea of what reality is like. So it's very key never to, you know, to not get all self-righteous about how I did this gift or I did this ethical thing or I did this tolerant thing and so on. It's very important not to do that. So generosity. In Buddhist social theory, the Buddhists wrote many works of advice to kings. And in the Indian system, Buddhist kings tended to be generous. And the Buddhist advice to them, they would write things like, don't have a big harem. You don't really need too many women. And it's like a waste of, then you have to build big buildings for them, and then it depletes your treasury. and also they feel unhappy between each other, and don't do that. And don't build big palace with a million rooms. You can only be in one room at a time. Advice like that they would give to these kings. And then they say, keep some grain in the royal granary so that if there are times of scarcity or famines or droughts, then you can release the stores of grain so that the merchants won't hoard, you know, and drive up prices and things like that. And have free motels on the roads. Plant trees on the roads so travelers have shade. And then have free guest houses where you put medicine and food, etc., for people, and have some caretaker at that guest house. So travelers through your kingdom will have a free, could stay freely and safely somewhere. And he even says, and have a special attendant who goes to the anthills and puts honey and grain near the anthills so the ants can get food easily. Like environmentalist kind of advice, you know. And no death penalty. This is in the second century of the Common Era. No death penalty. The worst murderer can be rehabilitated. But if they're still a danger to the people, you can imprison them. But then you work on teaching them and rehabilitating them. And the most dire, the most hopeless case, banishment to some sort of secure place where they can't escape and come back and kill more people is the only way. And this virtue is very much built into the Buddhist thing and the generosity. Like, how did you, when we were animals, when we were deers, when we were tigers and lions, how did we get to be humans? We let some being go. But it was very difficult to accumulate the generosity of becoming a human, where you have this kind of a hand. And how did we get a hand like this that has an opposing thumb and can... By opening it, by giving. No claws, you know. We don't have claws, vicious claws. We have fingernails, but they break very easily, right? Don't they? If you really try to claw something, it doesn't work well, right? The Chinese empresses sometimes used to wear metal fingernail things to make themselves look fierce. But the normal human fingernail is very wimpy. You could scratch somebody, but not very well. Your cat can really outdo you. So it's a vision of biology. The Buddhist vision of biology connects generosity to emptiness and to selflessness. And the insight of selflessness makes you improve your biological form. And the summit of biological achievement is to become an enlightened being where you can have multiple bodies. A Buddha is a being that can have as many bodies as are necessary. In their view, you know, it seems unrealistic to us at first when we're not used to it, and even later, actually, still seems unrealistic. Like Syria, like if you can have many bodies, where's the Buddha patrol, you know, out there putting a stop to that? Where is it? Well, how can such a thing go on, you know, the way it's going on? It's just inconceivable. So I get very impatient. I once had, when I was in Elmore, actually, once, I had this dream. Because that time when we were there, my friend Krishna Das was here, was in the Almora area at that same time, and sometimes in Almora. And that was 71 when they're having that summer was the Bangladesh Holocaust, where the West Pakistanis, with Kissinger and Nixon's encouragement, killed several million people, probably. Nobody knows the exact count, but it was a definite, like a Cambodian-type genocide thing. And which was really sort of Punjabis versus Bengalis. Never mind, they were both Muslims. It was those are different nations, different countries, different cultures, different languages. And we were very upset about that at the time. Different people were. And that's where I really got to love Ram Dass. I'll tell that story in a second. Anyway, I had this dream one night in Snowview, where I was staying, and I was really mad. With everything, with Buddhism, with my teacher, I was so upset by Bangladesh. Because in the Indian press, you saw all these pictures and all this atrocity. Terrible things, really terrible. And so my teacher, my first teacher, not the Dalai Lama, but my Mongolian old Lama teacher, was sitting outside on a stone sort of table that we had outside our little hut. But there, I mean, this was in a dream, but he was there. And I came out of the hut and I was in a rage. And I was saying to him, like, what is this about the Nirmanakaya of the Buddhas? That's called the emanation body of the Buddha, the ability that a Buddha has to manifest many, many bodies if human beings need that, or any animal, not just humans, need such an embodiment to help them. I said, where are they? What is this thing of all this slaughter and this Holocaust going on down the Himalayan wall here, further down there in Bengal, down the river? What is it, you know? I was in this hill station in the Himalayas, and there were these snow peaks, giant snow peaks, 26,000-foot snow peaks, Nanda Devi, Trishul, that you could see. And I was seeing them in the dream. I mean, you could see them in the daytime when you're awake, too, but I was seeing them in a dream. And I was saying, where's that Nirmanakaya? Why aren't they in service there? Why aren't they out there stopping this? And he didn't say anything. He looked very grim, like I felt. But as I was more and more railing at him, his body got bigger and bigger and bigger. And pretty soon I was like a little flea down at his knees screaming at him. And he was blotting out these giant snow peak mountains. And it was just so big. It was like you don't really see the bigger picture sort of answer is actually what it was. Which didn't satisfy me at all. I woke up frothing. You know, like, I was not at all satisfied. And years later, I really appreciated Ram Dass actually at a talk he gave at Smith College after visiting us at home at Amherst, where we were in those days. And then we went over with him and he gave this talk. And in the talk, he mentioned how he'd had a conversation at that time with Maharaji, the Neem Karoli Baba, the guru of Krishna Das and Ram Dass, the late guru of him. And he said he was doing a similar complaint. I identified with my dream when he was saying, I was complaining to him bitterly. And what is this? How can this be? You know, where's Krishna? You know, where's Rama? Where's God? You know, that's in a theistic way. And Maharaji said to me, says Ram Dass, oh, don't you see? It's perfect. And then what's happening? You know? And then Ram Dass says, well, maybe from some perspective it's perfect, but it also stinks, he said. And when he said that, I really liked that. And it reminded, you know, another event that happened to me at that time in Almora was there was this horse. You know, I had a car, a Volkswagen camper, and I was actually the hippie ambulance of Almora. And when them hippie was pregnant or giving birth or they were sick or had an accident, I had to drive them to Nanital, to the hospital. And there, but where I lived, there was a road that was really difficult to get over. And so I used to pick up hitchhikers, Indians, who would go to the bazaar way down the mountain. And they could get a ride if they agreed to get out and push over this one place where the road was like really a gully. You know, but the Volkswagen could get over it if people pushed. And so one time we got stuck there. We didn't have enough hitchhikers. I had Lama Govinda's wife in the car with me. She wanted to get out and push, an elderly Parsi lady. But I said, no, you don't want to do that. So then there weren't a couple of people pushing. And then she was sitting in her seat. Then I heard this strenuous noise. You know, I was driving, you know, and putting it in gear. And they were pushing. We were rocking the thing back and forth to get over the spot. And I heard this noise from the right-hand seat. You know, noise like that. And she was sitting in the seat pushing against the dashboard. So I looked at her like that, and she looked at me, all bug-eyed, and said, but I think it helps. The mental force. So anyway, we got stuck there. So then we went over, there was a place where a bunch of hippies lived. And we went over to get some water. We were waiting for more people to come, and then we could be pushed. And then we discovered there was a horse, one of these little ponies they have in Himalayas that carry slate. You know, they're little pack horses. And this one was dying, and it was lying in the road, in the path. There wasn't a road there, in front of the house. And these guys were there, all gunjat out or whatever they were. You know? And the horse was there, and flies were buzzing around it, but it was alive. And they were leaving it. And we were, and you know, my kids were there. We were all kind of upset about it. So anyway, we ended up, we got that horse, and we picked it up. And I got some of these guys who wanted to ride way up the mountain afterwards to help me. We hauled that horse. We gave it some water. Uma brought it water, you know. And we hauled the horse and we put it in the car. And we drove it up the hill. And people pushed outside the horse up the hill. And we took and put it in the garage in Snowview. And we brought food and some hay and some water and all this. You went and got a vet, you know, et cetera. But we ended up, we couldn't keep the horse because it was too far gone. The legs were messed up. And so, but anyway, we put it out of its misery. But first, the doctor took me to the village of the guy who owned the horse because he said, otherwise I'd be assaulted as having killed his horse, you know. But the hippies were really mad. You're messing with its karma. The leopards will come and eat it later, and you're depriving them of food and all this, you know. But, you know, we were like, it's like the Buddhist story. There's another Buddhist story, talk about generosity, of a dove in a forest fire. And that dove was lost her nest to the fire, and she was feeling very despaired. And all other animals were running away, and she was like, you know, ready to let the fire burn her. She was just completely, you know, just desolate. And then she noticed the suffering of the other animals, not just her own suffering. Because other animals were trapped and they were being burned and they were fleeing through the forest. So she decided, okay, I will do something. And I'll go out that way. So she went and she flew into a nearby pond or lake. And then in the version of a modern firefighting helicopter, she would fly up over the forest fire and shake her wings and shake the drops of water out on the fire. And she just did that, eventually died, you know, wore herself out doing that, and did die doing that. But that was like a great virtue, and she was happy doing that, doing something about it. So it's even not prejudging whether it will work or be helpful or not, but just doing something about it. She just thought that was really cool. And it's given us an example of ethics and generosity both in an animal, you know. And then she was reborn much, much better. She was reborn as a helicopter in Nevada. You know, they have stories like that. Another one I really love is about ethics, though. This is not about generosity. But we're talking all of these. The three altruistic transcendences are generosity, justice, and tolerance, which sort of fit every kind of interaction of self and other, right? Generosity is giving of the self to the other, right? Tolerance is receiving injury from others without hatred or anger or reaction or, you know, it doesn't mean you wouldn't defend yourself maybe or stop someone from harming somebody else or even stop them from harming you, but it means you're not going to, like, eye for an eye, you know, or kill them because they stepped on your toe or whatever. You know what I mean? You're not going to react in that way because you have tolerance. Transcendent tolerance is like that. And then the one in between is ethics, which is, or justice or morality, which is where you try to interact appropriately, which is what I like to be the real meaning of justice, is justness, that which is just appropriate to situations, but is most beneficial to another. You know, you don't overgive, you don't over-tolerate, you don't undergive, you don't under-tolerate, you just exactly act interactively that is the most appropriate way. Justness, justice as justness. I really like that idea about justness. So those three together. But anyway, there's one I really like where Buddha was Indra in a particular world system. He was the king of the gods as a bodhisattva in his previous life. And the king of the gods, of the Olympus gods, are often fighting with the anti-gods in the Indian sort of mythology. They're some sort of, they're called like titans, you know, they're asuras, they're called. They're like anti-gods, and they live down on the slopes of the cosmic mountain, and they're jealous of the gods in their pleasure city, their Olympus city, which is called Sudarshana. I mean, it's not called Olympus, that's Greek. But they're just like the Greek thing, that sector of the Indian pantheon, you could say. And so Buddha in that life was the king of the gods, and he was leading the divine armies to defend the city and fighting with the Asura armies. And momentarily they were losing to the Asura army, and he was fleeing in his chariot from the battlefield to go and recoup and get some more gods and come back against the anti-gods. They always win. The gods always win. And that's why it was the anti-gods are the incarnations of jealousy and power. You know, they're like power people, you know. And but as he's going down a narrow forest path, he sees an eagle's nest, and he sees the chariot pole is going to knock down the little chicklings. You know, the eagle, it has chicks in it, you know. Or they're like, they're doing their thing, waiting for mom to come back with a carcass or something. And he sees that. He says to his charioteer, stop, stop. And he says, what do you mean stop? The Asura army is chasing you, my lord. And he says, well, never mind, you know. These rules of war, that collateral damage is unacceptable. Why should we knock down those chicks? They have nothing to do with this war between the gods and the anti-gods. turn around, I'm going back that way. But we can't, there's no other path. We're going to go right back into the hands of the enemy troops, he says. I don't care. You know, I'm Indra, I don't care. I'm not going to knock down that nest. So they turn the chariot around somehow, and they charge back the other way. And of course, typical Buddhist thing, when the asuras see him coming, they assume that the divine army is behind him, so they all run away. So it's okay. But I love that type of small thing, you know, the little ego in the middle of the sort of larger thing, really against collateral damage, you know, with that ethical story. You know, is, you know, there's thousands of these stories. You know. That's how, with these narratives, how they shaped the cultures, the Buddhist cultures of Asia, which is why they became more peaceful, which is why the Western people could conquer them. First the Muslims, then the Judeo-Christians from the West. And the fact that they conquered those countries proves that those people were more civilized, actually, than the Europeans at that time, rather than that the Europeans were more civilized or more better. They invented gunpowder. They invented the compass. They invented those things in Asia, but they didn't use them for warfare. They were far from all enlightened and far from perfect, but they were more peaceful than we are still. They were. Someday history will be told that way. The more peaceful ones. You know, the meek shall inherit. Didn't Jesus say the meek shall inherit the earth? What did he mean by that? That's a weird statement. How is that going to happen? They're going to inherit the David Koch polluted oil field spilled, air quality destroyed, Monsanto polluted cornflakes? I don't think so. I think they're going to clean it up. So then tolerance is a big one. I was going to save that a little more for later, but tolerance, you know, one reason I wrote this commentary and one reason I make such a fuss about the infinite lifestyle is that true self-transformation, you need your power. Now, Eckhart Tolle is a friend of mine, not a close friend, but we share a very close friend, and I've had a few lunches with him, and we're friendly. And I pointed out to him, you know, the power of now, you know, that some of you must know about. And I think it's a great thing. I like it. But the now is relates to how you define the now. If the now is just a moment of anticipatory nothingness, it still is a palliative to people's anxieties, in the sense that they stop worrying about the future, they stop, you know, like resenting over the past, and they just be in the moment, you know. And that's kind of healthy. But that moment somehow is disconnected from causation. The materialist worldview means that if you come into that thing where you don't anticipate the future, you don't harp on the memory of the past, and you're just completely focused on what's happening right now, the place where you come subliminally fits within your larger definition that ultimately you're nothing. And ultimately causation falls into the black hole of nothingness. And it's all meaningless and purposeless. And that's what it gives you, that you don't worry about the future and you don't remember about the past. And you're taking anticipatory escape in a moment of nothingness, which is calm and peaceful. It's like a ibuprofen. But it's numbing. And it's unrealistic, actually. So I said to him, I said, you know, like Oprah, remember, I don't know if some of you may remember, when Oprah read The Power of Now herself, and she had, therefore, Eckhart on her programs and things, did that wonderful teaching event that they did together, she felt huge transformation in her life, like the earth moved, because she realized that everything was now, which is great. But when you come back out of that, and then you're back in the same depressing, it's all meaningless and useless and worth, and you know, all there is just let's have a little more, like a decent, let's have some nice moment, let's have that moment of now in a nice bathtub, with a nice jacuzzi, with wine, after a nice wine, with a good meal, etc. Let's not have it in Syria. Let's not go and help the refugees, the exiles coming in our nice clean Germany or whatever. Let's not do that. And so I said to Eckhart, if the now is pregnant with your future of an infinite, consequential, meaningful future, then you can be totally in the now, because actually it's always now in one way, and in another way, there is no such thing as now. There's no now. Where's now? Is it when I said the end or when I went ow? As you know, like a split second is not there. It's like a point is not there. A line has no width. A point has no size. A split instant has no length. There's a before and after always have a moment, right? There's a start in the middle and end of a moment. So if you analyze a moment, it disappears under analysis. So in a way, there is no now, right? Without past and future, there's no such thing, you know? So if the now that they come to, they make every moment count, because, and make it good, and make it better, that's not a stress. That's like a way of being vibrant in the now, where the now is infinity. The now has the seed of a positive infinity. And if you let the now have negativity in it, that's the seed of a negative infinity. Although, I have a theory, positive infinity is more infinite than a negative infinity, so don't worry. I can prove it mathematically, I think. When do we stop? I don't want to run over time.
11:30.
Oh, good. 11:30?
Yeah.
Oh, good. We have plenty of time. Oh. So Eckhart liked that. And I said, so how can you do that? Of course, he says, you people in this culture resist the idea of former and future life. But how can you emphasize whatever they don't resist in regard to continuity? You know, so that, you know, like humanists say, well, we care about the planet. Well, we care about the... The Dalai Lama thinks he should just be secular with them, and they're going to care about their children and grandchildren and the planet and so forth, although that's where he and I have a debate. I think that if the person has a feeling that they won't be there, like George Bush told Woodard when he asked George Bush about, Jr., about what didn't he fear about, you know, canceling the EPA and polluting the earth, etc., that his grandchildren and great-grandchildren would not think kindly of his memory. And he said, hadn't he polluted Texas horribly when he was governor and so on? And why was he doing this to the whole country and the whole world? And he said he didn't care what they would think about him because he wouldn't be there. Because he's so blunt. And in that way, he's nice and sweet, Mr. Bomb Thine Enemy guy. He blurts out what he really thinks. The other ones all think that. They're just too smart to say it. And they want to act like they care. But I believe that you have to feel that you're going to be involved and you're going to be there as well as everyone else. In other words, that there should be enlightened self-interest to reinforce whatever degree of altruism there is in the secular humanist. You need that enlightened self-interest to really get the power to do it. You know, you have to be part of the picture. You have to care about yourself in the future. That's more realistic, I feel. So the earth moving thing that is the shift from the terminal lifestyle to the infinite lifestyle is what you do is going to really matter for a really long time. But there's no eternal fixed thing that it'll be absolutely this or that. But in a way, sort of there is kind of, you know, when you become all of it, then you really will be free of any negative state. But you're still there with others who are going to have a negative state, so you're still going to be working with them in a way. So, you know, you can argue one way or another. The dualistic language will never quite settle it, theoretically. Suddenly this now. There's a wonderful verse in what's called the King of Samadhis, the Royal Meditation Sutra, or the King Meditation Sutra, which says, who understands cause and effect, understands emptiness. That is, when you look at relativity and really understand it's kind of, that it's infinite, then you realize that it's empty of any non-infinite thing, or it's empty of any sort of non-relative thing. So that means you understand emptiness. And who understands emptiness becomes mindful of the most minute details of things. I love that because it's sort of counterintuitive at first. We sort of tend to think, and there are so many mystics who tell us, actually, spiritual mystics, quote-unquote. This is not mystical. This is rational, reasonable. But there are so many mystics who tell us that, oh, the ultimate reality, the heart of God, nirvana, you know, everything is some state of completely outside this world. You know, Brahma wakes up from his dream and it's all one and it's just him. And there's no suffering being. Really, that was just a complete illusion. So you don't have to worry about anybody else after that. So there's a lot of that. And then there is an experience that you would have where everything seems to disappear and you feel a release, even from your body, even from any sense of time. And you feel this great release. Of course, you don't stay in it. But when you come back, you think, well, that's where I will go. I'm just now have the habit energy of my body, but I'll go back there to that nirvana later when I die. There are many people who interpret it like that. And the non-dualism means that is not the case. Those release states are valuable because they let us see the relativity of our non-release states and that our differentiated state here, I'm not an absolute in it, you're not an absolute in it, the pillar's not an absolute in it. We're all swimming around in a flow as relatives. And as relatives, therefore, our absolute concern is that all our relatives are happy. And there's no sorrow and suffering as much as possible. And actually, it is possible, they say, if we can make it into a Buddha verse. So therefore, when you understand emptiness properly, and the emptiness of emptiness, you know, the relativity of the absolute, let's say, even, when you understand that, that the absolute is the relativity, it can't be container of the relativity because that makes it relative. It can't be the underground of the relativity. It can't be the heart of the relativity. It just is the relativity. And therefore, the improvement of the relativity, of the universal freedom from suffering of all beings, becomes the only relatively absolute concern, you can say. Right? So that gives you tremendous power. That gives your practice, your creativity, your use of your human life. Knowing that your human life is this incredibly valuable evolutionary platform, opportunity, wherein you can truly overcome your instinctual level of selfishness, your instinctual delusion about the status of the self, your instinctual greed relating to that delusion that since you are the one and the rest want to just take it all away from you, you better get as much as you can of it yourself. And then hostility, assuming that others are feeling that way and want to take everything of yours, want to consume you. So those two secondary, primary things of greed and hostility, you know, lust and hate, you know, which arise from that sense of your absoluteness and separateness from everything else, which is this unviable situation causing suffering. So the difference between pointing your finger to someone, oh, go over there, that's where you want to go, or, oh, you want to go over there. That becomes infinite difference. This gives you the power to be mindful to make the honored guest gesture, to be mindful to shake the hand in the absolutely great way. You know, remind you to choose the right word to convey what you want to mean. Remind you to restrain the little negative implication of some other kind of thing, you know. This tiny detail becomes really important. Like that's why this translation is not really finished. If you notice when we read it, I go he, she, and I alternate he and she. Because going he or she, at one point, at the beginning I go he or she, but then I fall back into going he, which is bad. In Sanskrit, there's a grammatical rule that the masculine case, because it's an inflected language, the masculine case will stand for masculine and feminine when used in a general sense. But still, people go he all the time. And we have human, you know, we say mankind, you know, kind of when you want to be eloquent, you talk about mankind. Man is this, and man is that. And people think you're being kind of weird and technical when you say humankind or human. You say you. Who's the you part? Hey, that's the missus. The missus is there in the who. But I like to alternate them is what I usually do. When I, nowadays, in the last 20 years, I've done that. I wrote that a little long ago.